Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt, and welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? If you haven't heard already, the FCC here in the United States has voted against or to repeal the net neutrality laws. That means that Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and other terrible companies like that can now dictate how you see information and what you need to pay to get access to other things. So if you enjoy In Defense of Plants, if you like having botanical or any information or really anything on the web available to you, regardless of what a company like Comcast thinks about it, you should definitely call your representative, because Congress is the only one left between the FCC and, you know, these kind of companies ruling how we use the internet. So please, call your representatives. Call them. Call them. Let them know how you feel. All right, what do I have for you this week? We're actually going to explore an area of the tropics that is largely overlooked. And I'm talking, of course, about tropical dry forests. So these are the tropical forests that essentially have a prolonged dry season. In some areas, they actually are deciduous, so during the dry period, a lot of trees will drop their leaves. But they're, as you're going to hear, largely abused and just completely overlooked when it comes to conservation. That's not to say they're not incredibly important, and those are the kinds of things that our guest today is focusing on with her career. Joining us from the University of Minnesota is Dr. Jennifer Powers. Now, Dr. Powers focuses on certain elements of the tropical dry forest ecosystem, specifically things like carbon and nitrogen cycling, as well as how these systems are going to change over time, especially in the context of ever-accelerating man-made climate change. Her work is super fascinating, and her passion for these ecosystems is much needed. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. But before we get there, just a few orders of business to take care of first. If you're enjoying this podcast and you'd like to support it, please head on over to patreon.com/indefenseofplants and see what we got going on over there. For a little bit of money each month, you can get yourself kickbacks like stickers, access to the VIP section of the indefenseofplants.com website, and for those of you looking to get a little bit more in return, you can even get yourself a producer credit on this show. For instance, today's episode is produced in part by Daniela, Brody, Kevin, Katharina, Sammy and Sven, Sophia, Plants by Design, Mark, Renz, Bendix, Aaron and A, Holly, Clifton, Shane, Caitlin, Rosanna, Mary Jane, Manuel, Jennifer, Sarah, Sienna and Garth, Troy, Margie, and Laura. So thank you to everyone who has given thus far. It really does mean the world to me, and it's going such a long way in keeping this podcast up and running. I could not be doing it without you, and I'm very happy to report that I've got some very exciting things in the works. And I have to thank everyone who has given thus far for allowing that to happen. So expect a lot of great content in the next couple of months as we enter the new year, and you only have yourselves to thank. I'm really excited, but I don't want to ruin any surprises just yet. So stay tuned. Speaking of staying tuned, the best way to do that is to give this podcast a review and hit subscribe on whatever pod portal you use to download it. Not only do subscriptions help you stay up to date, but your input helps me make a better podcast, and it helps In Defense of Plants reach a wider audience. The goal of In Defense of Plants is to spread the love of botany around the globe to help cure plant blindness, one episode at a time. And with your reviews and subscriptions, that becomes even more possible. Subscriptions and reviews are how the podcatchers make recommendations to people that haven't heard the podcast yet. So if you've ever gotten onto iTunes and looked down at the bottom and saw, hey, you might enjoy this, that's because someone reviewed it and they like podcasts similar to you, and the algorithm thinks you might like it as well. Also, we still have stickers for sale. indefenseofplants.com/shop. Head on over there, check them out. They are designed by Tom Pearson Designs. They look great, they're waterproof, you can put them anywhere, and 50% of every purchase is being donated to the North American Orchid Conservation Center, so it's for a good cause. They're working really hard on increasing land protection and research to help preserve North America's wonderful orchid diversity. Speaking of preserving orchid diversity, I'm really happy to announce that the Ecominga Foundation, in concert with the Orchid Conservation Alliance and the Rainforest Trust, were able to buy that valuable habitat corridor in Ecuador, which not only protects valuable rare habitat that's being gobbled up by agriculture, but unites two giant reserves that were put in place because of Dracula orchids. So if you were one of those people that helped donate, thank you very much. This is the kind of stuff we need to be doing a lot more of. And maybe after today, we can start talking a little bit more about tropical dry forest conservation. So, with that being said, let's head on over to my conversation with Dr. Powers. I hope you enjoy. All right, well, Dr. Powers, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Well, thanks a lot, Matt. This is really a pleasure to be here and to talk about tropical dry forest. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm in the departments of ecology, evolution, behavior, and plant and microbial biology. And by training, I'm an ecosystems ecologist. And so I'm interested in how carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus cycle back and forth between plants, between soils and the atmosphere, if we're thinking about carbon and nitrogen. But that's sort of the bread and butter of what I do. I fell in love with tropical dry forests, I don't know, 16, 17 years ago. And I think once you fall in love with tropical dry forests, you can't fall out of love with tropical dry forests. And so really what I do is I'm a tropical dry forestologist, and we try to understand these forests from the perspective of the effects that humans are having on them. We're interested in how they respond to climate change. We're interested in how land use change affects the dynamics of species in these ecosystems, how land use change affects the biogeochemical cycles in these ecosystems.
Awesome. Okay, so there's a lot of questions that just came out of that. And before we even get to the meat of, like, what is a tropical dry forest?
Yeah.
I'm just curious. I mean, obviously you said you came to this system, you know, a little over a decade ago, but were you, as a kid, were you passionate about carbon and nitrogen and phosphorus cycling and plants, or did this kind of, how did you find your way into ecosystems ecology? Because it's kind of like, I always thought when I was going to visit my hand doctor, it's like, did you always want to be a hand doctor?
That's funny, because my father was a hand doctor.
Perfect.
He was a hand surgeon. Yeah, exactly. My grandfather was a geologist, and he was a great outdoorsman. He loved hiking. He loved looking at rocks. He knew, when I was a young kid, I would go visit him in Arizona, and he taught me the names of all the cacti and the desert. And my dad, too, loved being outdoors. And I mean, it sounds very cliched, but I think people who wind up in ecology are people who like being outdoors. And so I was drawn to a career that somehow involved being outside or thinking about the things that were going on outside of buildings. And how I came to be interested in carbon cycling and nitrogen cycling, you know, I think those, I gravitated towards those questions in college when I was doing my bachelor's thesis. And I did a bachelor's thesis looking at how free-living nitrogen-fixing bacteria interact with wood decay fungi. That was a long time ago. And it's funny because those are two things that I still study to these days. I guess I've always been fascinated about how, you know, how biology mediates these transformations of elements from one pool to another. To me, I think I've done a lot of work on soil carbon, and soil carbon to me is like black magic. It's the largest, if we added up where the carbon is on the planet, there's carbon in the oceans. That's a large pool of carbon that's inorganic. There is carbon in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. It's a much smaller pool. There's carbon that's tied up in the vegetation. And then there's this huge pool of organic carbon in soils. It's larger than the amount of carbon in plants. It's larger than the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. And that organic carbon in the soils, to me, is black magic, because it's turning, it's huge pool of carbon. Some of that carbon turns over on millennial timescales. Some of it turns over, you know, on the order of minutes. And it's the dynamics of this pool of carbon, to me, are fascinating. It integrates what's going on with the plants. It integrates what's going on with the microorganisms, with fungi, with bacteria. And it also is, the dynamics of soil carbon are tied very closely to the properties of the soil, mineralogy. So it integrates plants, microorganisms, and soil processes in this big, giant pool of carbon that we can't see, but we know is enormously important when we think about regulation of the climate or soil fertility.
Wow, a lot of food for thought in that. So where do tropical dry forests enter into this scene? I mean, what are they first and foremost, and why do you use that system in particular to work on this issue of carbon storage pools and cycling and fluxes?
Yeah, so I think when a lot of people think of tropical forests, you know, they think of Tarzan swinging on lianas through a rainforest, or they think of Curious George. The vision of tropical forests, or the iconic tropical forest, is a rainforest. And I started off working in tropical forests in 1994, and I was working in in a rainforest, in a very wet forest. I did my dissertation work working in a wet forest, and then got a postdoc working in the Guanacaste Conservation Area in Costa Rica in a tropical dry forest. And that was when I really started thinking about these systems as not just as sort of the poorer cousin to a tropical rainforest. If you added up all the forest area in the tropics, areas that are considered seasonally dry tropical forests would account for about 40% of the potential forest cover of the tropics. These are seasonally dry tropical forests have lower rainfall compared to rainforests or wet tropical forests, and the rain that does fall tends to be seasonal. So there are alternating wet seasons and dry seasons in these forests. And as a result of this climate seasonality or rainfall seasonality, many of the trees in seasonally dry tropical forests are deciduous or drought deciduous. So just like in the temperate zone here in Minnesota or in Illinois, many trees, you know, think of oaks, think of maples, they lose their leaves during the winter. In tropical dry forests, many trees lose their leaves during the dry season. And so that's one of the distinguishing features of these forests. And why did I fall in love with them? Well, why do you fall in love with anyone, right?
So true.
There's something that's sort of mystical, I guess, there that's hard to figure out. But I think from the perspective of an ecologist, these dry forests are really fascinating systems to ask a whole host of questions. If you think about how environmental gradients drive ecological processes, I think the dry forests are a fabulous place to work because there are these seasonal gradients of rainfall, periods with very high rainfall, periods with very low rainfall. There's an enormous range of variability in soil parent material, in soil characteristics that we know control biogeochemical cycles. And then when we think of the functional diversity of the plants, of the trees that live in these forests, there's this incredible array of functional types. So there are true evergreen species in these forests that always have a canopy of leaves. There are true drought deciduous species that always lose their leaves at the beginning of the dry season. And then there's every kind of tree phenology strategy you could think of in between. Some trees they're called brevi deciduous. They drop their canopy of leaves at the beginning of the dry season and then flush a new canopy of leaves. There are species that are called semi-deciduous and they lose some of their leaves during the dry season, but not all of the canopy of their leaves. So there's this huge range of functional types or functional diversity in the traits or the characteristics of the species of trees that live in these dry forests. So if you overlay those climate gradients, soil gradients, and then gradients in functional diversity, it's a really fascinating place to understand how those variables interact to control biodiversity and also to affect ecosystem processes or nutrient cycling.
So this unique position, which as you described is almost approaching half of the forest types in these tropical zones, really do kind of set this natural laboratory where these experiments are almost set up by the processes you just mentioned, and then you can go in and look at them differently. But then you kind of mentioned all this functional diversity, and I personally had never really thought about tropical dry forests, and then I went and hiked in one. And I didn't know I was doing it. I didn't know what to expect. And I walked around and I was going like, okay, there's weird elements of like the Western U.S. feel here. Then there's strange elements of like a red cedar forest. It just was so different. And without even knowing it was a thing, I could tell that it was different. So what kind of plants are these? I mean, phylogenetically speaking, are there certain types, at least in the systems that you work in, that are really prone to live in these habitats? Or is it kind of like whatever you see in the rainforest or the wetter areas, you have representatives of that lineage in the dry forests as well?
That's a great question. And I'll speak mostly from the perspective of the neotropical dry forests or the dry forests in Mesoamerica, Central America, South America. There are, if you were to look at the plant species and the plant families, what you would find in a dry forest is a large component of leguminosae or legume trees. The legume family is huge, you know, I don't know, 19,000 species. It's huge, it's functional. functionally diverse, but it's also really interesting from a biogeochemical perspective because many of the legume species can fix nitrogen. So in addition to this sort of interesting biogeochemical capability of many of the legume species, many of them have very small leaflets. So the leaves are pinnate or bipinnate. They're compound leaves that are finely dissected. And one of the things we're looking at now is to try to understand how the distribution of Fabaceae or legumes varies across successional gradients. So forests that are regenerating following abandonment from agriculture and also climatic gradients. And what we're finding with this work is that Fabaceae or legumes seem to be overrepresented in dry forests and in particular in early successional dry forests. And we think this is due to a combination of the ability to fix nitrogen, but also the characteristics of these leaves. You would find, you know, one thing that might differ if you were to walk from a wet forest, from a rainforest to a dry forest, is the palms. Abundance and diversity of palms would decrease going from a wet forest to a dry forest. And you would notice, if you were looking, that the abundance of trees with compound leaves and trees from the family Fabaceae or Leguminosae would increase as you moved into this drier climatic zone.
Weird.
So Fabaceae is really a huge component of these forests.
Okay, so you mentioned the leaves and the compound leaves, and that's something I think everyone, when they look at most Fabaceae, they go, oh yeah, there's either trifoliate or multiple leaflets, and then other trees as well. Mm-hmm. What about that particular trait, because I love kind of bringing this together.
Yeah.
What about that kind of predisposes them, perhaps, or just selects for living in these tropical dry areas?
So some of the hypotheses that we're trying to follow up on and put forth in the literature are that this trait of having compound leaves and having smaller leaflet size and area allows legumes to dissipate heat quicker. So it is an adaptation to very hot and potentially very dry conditions that early successional legumes would find themselves in. So the trait of compound leaves and the trait of having small leaflet sizes is thought to be an adaptation to dealing with sort of the boundary layer dynamics of heat. We also think that there are adaptations to water use efficiency, which include things like being able to, well, legumes have, in general, they have higher density wood. And so there's wood traits that allow them to use water more efficiently. If we think about the leaflet traits, not only can they dissipate heat quickly, compound leaf legumes have these pulvini, which allow the leaves to sort of fold up. If it becomes too hot for photosynthesis, the leaves can fold up. So essentially the legumes are regulating their leaf area. So that's another adaptation for hot, dry conditions. What we seem to be noticing from the data we're looking at are that there's probably multiple adaptations to dealing with heat stress, to dealing efficiently with water, in addition to the ability to fix nitrogen. And all of these traits are really overrepresented in the early successional legumes that we find in the dry forests.
Wow. So you see the situation where the constraints of actual physics and the transfer of energy and heat are really kind of constraining the not only just the traits, but the types of species that can then inevitably live in this environment. So, you know, when you think of the tropics, you think of kind of this relaxed stress on the plant life. There's a lot of water. There's a lot of sunlight. It's more about competition. But in these systems, it sounds more like it's way more limited by the stress of the abiotic environment itself and the lack of water and the intense heat and sunlight that's coming into the system.
Definitely. I think that's a really astute observation. I think the potential for environmental filtering of these abiotic conditions to really act as a process that constrains which types of species you find in dry forests and which types of species you find sort of thriving in these early successional dry forest environments, I think that those are very strong filters for which species can germinate, can establish, and can thrive in these early successional dry forest ecosystems.
Okay, so bringing it back to your realm of research, though, you've talked about how this physical environment and how even wood densities can help buffer a tree against coming up against drought and intense heat. What does that have to do now with carbon cycling? I mean, how does all that come back around to what's going on with these soil carbon pools?
Well, that's a great question. And some of those connections have been made and some of those connections haven't been made. So we've thought a lot about tropical dry forests in the context of succession. And some of the reasons why why we have been thinking about dry forests in succession is that these forests across the tropics, so if we looked in India, if you looked in Africa, if you looked in the neotropics, dry forests have been preferentially colonized by people and converted to other land uses, to grazing, to crops. And so what little dry forest we have left on the planet tends to be secondary forest. So that's why we put a lot of our energy into understanding these successional processes in dry forests. How that relates to carbon cycling, I think it relates to carbon cycling in a couple of direct ways and then in a couple of indirect ways. If we think about secondary succession in wet forests and dry forests, the processes of secondary succession in the tropics have been pretty neglected, I would say, for the last 10-15 years. And what we've really seen recently is a huge interest, you know, after people really realized, wow, the sort of our ideas of a primary tropical rainforest, and there's a lot of intact forest left in Brazil, there's a lot of intact forest left in a few countries. But really, if we looked across all forests in the world, forests are secondary. The majority of the forests that we have now on the planet are growing back. They are regenerating following some form of agriculture. This is true in the temperate zone. It's true in the tropics. So if we think about successional processes in the tropics, you know, there's a great interest in understanding how quickly biomass stocks accrue as forests are regenerating, above ground biomass increases. There's been a lot of work recently to try to synthesize, you know, what are the controls on how fast forests regenerate and biomass accrues, thinking mostly from the above ground perspective. And so these syntheses have been led by the second four network of chronosequences. What these studies are finding is fairly rapid rates of recovery of biomass. People are interested in this because this relates directly to the carbon sequestration potential of tropical secondary forests. If we think about how that translates to below ground processes, so as you know, so we know this process of secondary succession is occurring in wet tropical forests, in dry tropical forests. We can measure and map pretty well how the above ground carbon stocks change as young forests develop into older forests. You know, understanding if soil carbon changes across those chronosequences, understanding how nutrient cycling changes in response to forest regeneration, and whether or not nutrient availability or nutrient, you know, soil fertility is a constraint on the rate of secondary forest succession. Those are questions we don't have a very good handle on, I would say, in wet forests or in dry forests.
So, I mean, this you mentioned that this soil organic carbon in this area is kind of a black magic, but it's also kind of this black box, is that we're really just starting to get our heads wrapped around what these processes are. And what you just kind of described there to me is this nice melding of what you learn about succession early on in, you know, high school, if you're even lucky enough to talk about it then. Yeah. But entry-level biology courses is that the plants change over time. The plants you see in a fallow field are going to be very different than the plants you see in a climax, quote-unquote, forest type. Mm-hmm. And that goes the same for these tropical dry forests, is that the plants are changing over time. And what it sounds to me like is like if you pick up the leaf of, you know, a legume in an early successional plot versus the leaves of the canopy of something like a approaching a climax forest, the way that they go into the soil and decompose and change the soil properties are going to be different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's right. So there's a couple of ideas that are being talked about a lot in the literature now. One is how the traits of the trees that you would find in an early successional versus a late successional habitat, how those characteristics of the traits differ, how those functional traits or characteristics of the trees differ. And then the other question is how those differences affect what's going on below ground. A lot of work has been devoted within the last 10 years to understand the functional traits of succession, or of early to late successional trees, and how that differs between wet and dry forests. And so the ideas now are that early successional environments in dry forests are very, you know, are they're hot, they're dry, and trees that thrive in those environments will have what we would consider conservative traits. As those early successional forests develop in dry areas, there should be gradual closing in of the canopy, and that will ameliorate some of the harsh microclimatic effects or microclimatic conditions And so we should see if we look either through time and an early successional site becoming a late successional site in the drive force, or if we look, you know, using a chrono sequence at young sites to old sites, we should see the traits of the trees going from conservative traits to acquisitive traits, light demanding to sort of shade tolerant, but mostly driven through water and nutrient availability or nutrient constraints in the dry forest. People are finding sort of the opposite patterns in a wet forest, where the major environmental factor that drives the abundances and distributions of trees with different characteristics across wet forest succession, you tend to see the early successional trees being acquisitive, high rates of carbon cycling, high rates of nutrient uptake, and transitioning then from acquisitive to conservative traits through succession. So to summarize that, there seems to be these two opposite ways that the functional traits of trees differ between a wet forest succession and an early forest succession. How those different characteristics of plant communities then feed back to affect what's going on with below ground carbon cycling has really not been fleshed out, because there are simultaneous changes in the micro environments, you know, going from a hot, dry soil to a soil that has relatively more soil moisture in a later succession site. You could imagine how that would affect some a process like litter, leaf litter decomposition. On the other hand, there's undoubtedly changes in the inputs to the soil of carbon as forests regenerate. And so if we think about soil carbon dynamics, it's a function, you know, the size of the soil carbon pool is a function of inputs to the system, so through plant productivity, through microbial processes, and then outputs through decomposition or, you know, leaching or erosion. But the dynamics of what happens to carbon, you know, as it's being stored in the soil and processed in the soil also has a lot to do with the mineralogy of the soil. So there's all these interacting factors. And, you know, at this point, simple models, I think, would simple models of inputs versus outputs and how that changes over succession may not really reflect the dynamics of what's going on.
I'm just picturing you coming out of the lab going, we're going to need more arrows.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
No, it's fascinating.
Exactly right.
Because what you're kind of outlining is this idea that really context matters, right?
Context matters a lot. Yeah.
And that's both, I think, can be troubling to ecologists, but also for people like me, that's very exciting, because it's telling me that species matter, and that it kind of needs, we need to foster this kind of becoming a hometown fan and knowing a certain area, getting people that know regional specific areas really, really well, because that's where the best form of understanding and the most applicable kinds of research are going to happen. But, you know, in your system where you work, what really are you starting to find? Are there patterns that are predictable to some extent? Or again, is it kind of just, well, it depends on which species are here and what the conditions are in the soil?
Yeah, so those are great questions. Sort of the, you know, the idea of context specificity, how these processes depend on your particular combination of factors in each landscape or each ecosystem, and then how predictable is succession, or, you know, from species composition, is it deterministic? Is it stochastic? I mean, these are huge questions. And in ecology, the unfortunate answer is often, it's both, it's everything, it's nothing, it's everything. I think that I go back to my training in ecosystems ecology and soil science and think a lot about Hans Jenny, who put forth this paradigm, which we call the state factor theory, that if you want to understand the properties of a soil at one point in the planet, or the properties of a soil or an ecosystem at any point in the planet, you have to consider the climate of that site and the parent material that those soils were developed from, and the organisms or the biodiversity or the types of plants and animals that are there, and fungi and microorganisms, and topography of the site, and then time, the time over which weathering processes have been occurring. And then the sixth soil forming factor that has been recently proposed is the anthropogenic soil forming factor. So I think if we think about context, you know, and how we can generalize, you know, what you find in your forest to what I find in my forest, I think if we go through this list of, well, is the climate different? Is the, you know, how does soil parent material affect these dynamics? How does topography affect these dynamics? Then it can help us place ourselves in that sort of, it can help us identify which aspects of the context are different or similar. And I think that is a way to avoid the, oh, it all depends. You know, everything's different. My site's different than yours. It helps structure our questions. The state factor theory, I think, can help us structure our questions about in which ways does seasonality affect, you know, dynamics? In which ways does parent material affect, you know, sort of phosphorus cycling, you know, across these gradients? So some of the things that we're finding in our sites relate back to these issues of how parent material acts as a environmental filter. Parent material affects nutrient availability, and that in turn affects not only which species we find growing in our successional forest, but also the traits of those species. So we can trace this sort of clear line of cause and effect from parent materials that have, you know, we're starting with vastly different amounts of phosphorus in these different parent materials. And then we understand how the differences in parent materials affect the differences in available phosphorus. And now what we're starting to see is how those differences in nutrients across the sites that we work in affect which species we see there and which species with particular syndromes of functional traits. I think we can help understand that what seems like stochasticity, we can try to understand using a functional trait approach, using state factor approach, really which aspects are deterministic versus stochastic.
Wow. So it's a way of kind of making broad brushstrokes at a very specific measurements, so to speak. And like you said, you're looking for where these systems deviate to kind of teach you about which what really does matter in certain contexts and not others. So it is a way of scaling up to something that is not generalized, but a little bit more graspable and feasible in terms of how we then go forward in managing these systems or restoring these systems.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I think that's a great way to think about it.
Yeah, so it looks like you still got some work cut out for you in that regard, but it's such a cool approach at this point, because you really are starting to unlock these doors, and as you mentioned earlier, we're only just starting to understand that, so it's kind of this new exciting frontier of what's going on underneath the soil where the roots are.
Yeah, I completely agree, and some of the things that you see, you know, in the literature sort of popping up is really, you know, recently is really a focus on trying to understand how, you know, the microbial and in particular fungal contributions to organic matter cycling through the soil. And I think that is a, you know, that is a place where there's lots and lots of progress to be made in trying to understand how the presence or absence of different types of mycorrhizae, for example, will affect soil carbon cycling. I see a lot of work now trying to integrate microbial ecology into thinking about soil carbon cycling.
I always think about it in terms of when people talk about how little we understand the depths of the ocean or just the ocean in general. Well, at least you can put yourself in some sort of clear ball or tube that if it's strong enough, you can reach those areas. You can't just jump in a submarine and go underground and see things. It's such a unique set of challenges associated with studying that process.
Whew. Yeah, that's right. Although, have you been to the Field Museum?
I have, yeah.
In Chicago, I don't know if they still have it. They had this in the basement, I think, this below ground exhibit. And you go through, I went through this, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. You, like, they start off this doorway and it's like a miniaturizer or something. They said, we're shrinking you down so you can actually walk through the soil. And then you go through and there's like gigantic round balls that represent like nodules on a plant root and stuff. And they have these like, it's a fantastic exhibit. I went there with my kids and I could have spent all day there.
Oh, that's cool. I've been to the Thrill, I think, 3 or 4 times now, and I still have not seen most of even what's upstairs.
Yeah, well, go to the basement. Hopefully it's still there. It's a really amazing exhibit to try to put yourself, like, in the perspective of, like, a nematode or something.
And, like, that's cool.
And go through the soil. Yeah, it's really cool.
Awesome. Okay, so we've established that these places are important and that you mentioned earlier that they were differentially settled or at least farmed and stuff. I mean, what is it about that ecosystem that made humans go in and settle them more and not care about them as much in terms of preservation? Is it the fact that they're a little bit easier to work in because they're dry, or that just aesthetically they were always thought of as just kind of waste places and, well, who cares if we cut them down to the ground?
Probably all of those factors and more. These systems are, in general, on higher fertility soils than many rainforests. And so in a lot of ways, they're better for farming because of the dry season, the strong dry season. These are also sites where it's easier to control vegetation through fire. And so it was much easier to go into a dry forest during the dry season, burn it, and then establish a field or a pasture than to go into, you know, a place that gets 4 or 5 meters of rainfall a year. You know, in general, I think from the perspective of human comfort, it's nicer to be in a place where you're not being rained on every single day. So I think, you know, the combination of high fertility soils, the combination of favorable climates for agriculture and for sort of humans, and the ability to manipulate vegetation with fire, all of those factors conspired to, you know, to make dry forests, seasonally dry forests, the ecosystems that were preferentially exploited and converted by people historically.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It's kind of path of least resistance, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
all the fungal infections that come with being humid and moist all the time. But, you know, in terms of diversity, I'm always thinking about biodiversity, and you know, I do functional trait work as well, and a lot of that kind of eliminates the need to think about the species identity and what complement of different species are there and the individuals themselves. But what you were hinting at this whole time is that species identity really does kind of matter, and just because a system doesn't have the exact number that this other system does or is slightly less doesn't make it any less viable. So in terms of biodiversity, I mean, these are hosting unique species. These are hosting important keystone species. Species identity matters in these habitats, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the appealing things about working in dry forest to me is that, you know, my postdoc advisor always said the dry forests are great because there's, you know, they are high diversity systems if we think about the tree communities, but they're not hyper diverse. So A, there's, you know, replication of species. So if you want, there's replications of individuals within species. So you're not looking at, you know, one individual of a species per hectare being abundant. You're looking at 5 or 6 or 10 or whatever. So if you're doing ecological work, it's great because you can have replication. So the diversity is high, but it's tracked. And I think that, from my perspective, that's nice because then you really get to know these species. Like we call them in my lab, the sort of handful of 30, we work with about 140 species. We work with about 30, 40 species that we call los sospechos usuales, or the usual suspects. And we've gotten to know these species really well. And so, you know, by getting to know these species well, you can tell, you know, when something's really different. In 2014, the rainy season was very delayed in starting. It usually starts around May. It really didn't start until September. And most of the trees had flushed out leaves, and Cedrella odorata lost all its canopy of leaves in July. And we just could look around because we know Cedrella well. We're like, you know, that's unusual. So getting to know these species well over a period of years allows you to sort of understand when something seems different. Having a group of species you also know well allow you to really, you know, to talk to people about the cultural value people place on these species. We say in my lab, you know, every species has a story. And if you talk to the people who do environmental education in Guanacaste, if you talk to the people who were loggers and who 50, 60 years ago were logging these sites, people recognize each individual species, and each individual species does have a story. There's a species that flowers, it has beautiful white flowers, and it flowers in December. And so it's called a Christmas tree because you can use those flowers to decorate for Christmas. There are species that have great timber. You can really get to know each individual species, not only from its, you know, functional traits, from its role in unmanaged ecosystems, but also for its potential in restoration and forestry. And so, yeah, I think species do matter.
Good. That's such a nice takeaway. So, okay, I'm going to put you on the spot. If you've got the usual suspects or ones that are really important, is there one or two species that really stand out? Whether it doesn't have to be your favorite. I know that's hard to do. It's like picking favorite kids, but which if you do, that's fine. But yeah, what if there's one or two species that really stand out as either really important in the system or are your favorites, what are they and what's their kind of story?
Wow. Yeah, that's a great question. There's a couple of, you know, there's some of them that are just like, you have to love because they're just so beautiful, right? And to me, the Fabaceae are really beautiful. Enterolobium gets to be enormous. That Enterolobium cyclocarpum or the Guanacaste tree is just spectacularly beautiful. But there's others that this, the place that we work in Guanacaste, Costa Rica, is the southern extent of the range of Quercus oleoides. So it's the lowland oak, and where it occurs in high abundance. So it dominates the sites locally, and these tend to be low fertility soils. And so the oak is interesting for a number of reasons. It supports ectomycorrhizae, you know, it has acorns, it's playing a role in the animal communities, it's playing a, probably a different role in the below ground community by supporting ectomycorrhizae. So the oak definitely I would think of as one of these different species that you have to get to know if you're working Guanacaste. But then the legumes are just they're just beautiful. They're beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
once you see those, you fall in love with them.
Easy enough to do. I can understand that. Very cool. Well, yeah. If people want to find out more about your work and keep up to date, what's the best way of them finding you and reaching out?
Oh, well, thanks. Let's see. I have a website, which is called tropicaldryforest.wordpress.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Jennifer_Pow, P-O-W, on Twitter. And you can email me. I always like getting emails.
Yeah.
powers@umn.edu.
Excellent. I will put up links to all those. Well, thank you so much for giving us a lot of food for thought. I mean, going forward, any recommendations? I mean, should people care and conserve and work harder to give a little more attention to these tropical dry forests?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without a doubt, people should care, concern, try to conserve tropical dry forests, but they should care about and try to conserve every forest. Forest in your backyard, forests in Costa Rica, forests, you know, in the boreal zone. I'm a pro forest person. So I think we need to think locally and we need to think globally. We need to think and care at what's going on in our backyards and then what's going on in other people's backyards.
Perfect. I think great sentiment to end on. So Dr. Powers, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us and happy research. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you so much, Matt. This was really fun.
Good, I'm glad. All right, bye.
Bye.
All right, how was that? I really like talking to Dr. Powers. She is just so passionate and so much fun to talk with. I was actually really fortunate to meet her this semester. She came and gave an excellent seminar, and it's just, she got a lot of people talking about tropical dry forests after that, and that's awesome. It's always good to see scientists who can communicate their passion in a way that gets other people kind of fired up about a cause. It was a lot of fun talking with her, and I thank her for taking time out of her busy schedule to talk with us. Again, indefensibleplants.com/shop. Pick up stickers. Help conserve orchid diversity here in North America. Also, patreon.com/indefensibleplants. Consider becoming a patron. If that's not in your cards, you can give a one-time donation. Just head on over to indefensibleplants.com, scroll down on the right-hand side of the screen, and click donate. Finally, youtube.com/indefensibleplants. We've got some really interesting things in the works. So stay tuned. The best way to do that is to hit subscribe. All right, everyone, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios.